So basically what we know is that all parts of the brain are malleable, changeable. The key is actually reaching the parts of the brain with sufficient repetition to cause change. If you end up getting opportunities for consistent, predictable, stable relationships over time, you will, over time, get better. Even if you had a bad start, you can get better.
Yes.
It just takes time.
And it takes people. All it takes is one person who believes in you. It's why every time I see the picture of Mrs. Duncan or a tape of Mrs. Duncan from when we had her on the show, I break into tears because I was saved by Mrs. Duncan, my fourth grade teacher, and other teachers around me. That's why I love teachers so much, because all it takes is one person who believes in you. And for a lot of children in this world, that's all they have, are the people who are in their churches or communities or, you know, schools. It's schools for most kids.
You were just listening to one of today's guests, Dr. Bruce Perry, talking with Oprah Winfrey. Dr. Perry was on episodes 126 and 127 to discuss trauma and brain science for coaches. Since then, he co-authored an amazing book titled What Happened to You? He co-authored that with Oprah. It's an absolute must-read for coaches, teachers, parents. I can't begin to tell you how much it's changed how I view my children, other difficult people in my life, and even myself. Anyways, we got back together with Dr. Perry recently and another previous guest, Megan Bartlett, to talk with them about brain science, like why coaches need to know about it and what they need to know. The reality is, with a better understanding of the brain, you'll not be able to help your players, but you're going to be able to help yourself more effectively. And that's what we're about in the Coaching Culture Podcast. Welcome. This podcast mission is to help coaches more positively impact the lives of their players and to grow as leaders. My name is JP Nurbin, and I'm joined by my co-host and friend, Nate Sanderson. Learn more about how we coach coaches through our mentorship and consulting program at tocculture.com. Now let's get right into today's conversation with Megan Bartlett and Dr. Perry, the world's leading trauma psychiatrist. His resume is ridiculous. It's too much for this podcast. Just Google his name or go to his website, bdperry.com, to learn more. All right, so Dr. Perry, my first question is for you here. I just want to ask you, why would a neuroscientist care about sports and coaching? Because I know you do a lot with the neurosequential model in education, other fields, but why sports? Why is that an area of interest?
Well, there's two reasons. One is I actually grew up as an athlete, so it just understanding how people worked and understanding how the body worked and understanding how the brain worked. Really, all of that was so intertwined with growing up as an athlete that it even as I went into the basic neurosciences and medicine, and I would talk to people about some of these ideas, I would use analogies from sport because it was just something that I had could pull out of my own experience. And that also a lot of other people have sort of a touch point in their own life about, you know, whether you're talking about motor coordination or you're talking about teamwork or you're talking about the relationship between repetitions and success, all of these are just part of sport, but they're also illustrating really important points about how the brain works. And so that was something that was just kind of happened because of the way I grew up. And then the second, probably I think the most important thing is when you look around at the experiences in our life that have the potential to build resilience, to make us more globally healthy, sport is right at the top of the list. Any experience where you are creating relationships, you're having a challenge, you're solving the challenge as a group, there's predictability to the challenge. You know, we know when the practices are going to be, we know when the games are going to be, and there's controllability. You know, we'll get better if we practice. So whenever there's what we call agency, and whenever you have the opportunity for meeting moderate challenges in a way that you experience stress that's predictable and controllable, you build resilience. And so I think it's, you know, we're living in a day and age where people are talking about stress all the time. And people have been, you know, even before the pandemic, people were down on education and they were kind of going after the curriculum and we have to train teachers better. We have to do all kinds of stuff. But I kept saying, listen, the very core of developing resilience. And if you want a better student, you really need to help them become better athletes. And so that's kind of why I kind of went off on a big tangent, but that's really why I bring sport and the brain together.
And Megan, you've obviously been doing a lot with sport as well. And we've had previous conversations on the podcast, but maybe just quickly for those that maybe aren't familiar with your work as well, what was the draw for you, you know, in trying to work with athletes and coaches?
Thanks, Nate. I will say, you know, the part three of the question to Bruce is the answer is an annoying woman on Twitter asked me to. the neurosequential therapeutics and education existed. And then this annoying woman was like, hey, there should be a neurosequential model of sport. And then keeps periodically showing up in his inbox being like, let's do more. But I think, Nate, to your question, that's, I was drawn to working in sport because of my background, you know, sort of in child development and, you know, what I had studied and what I was interested in and found in the sport space, how little people actually understood about young people, right? Who are working in the sport space and the people who are getting hired as coaches played sport, but didn't have a lot of understanding about what young people need in order to be successful, what they need from the adults in their lives, what they need from the training to be a better athlete. They sort of had one coach who did it one way, and then they go and coach that one way to kids without an understanding that different kids are going to need different things and sort of how to put all of that into practice. And they were, what they'd find is that they're not successful with a bunch of kids on the team. And then they'd say, well, it must be the kid's fault. You know, oh, well, those kids are, there's something wrong with kids today, or there's something wrong with these kids. And not how do I understand what's going on for young people better so that I can have a different approach for kid A, B, C, and D. The ability to be able to do the things that I was interested in sport just sort of snowballed and said, this is a need in the coaching world. This is a need in the sport world for people to understand kids better. So I sort of backed into it that way.
I wonder if for our listeners, you know, Dr. Perry, in your book, What Happened to You, I thought it was interesting the example that you used right in the opener to try to get the readers to start thinking about how the brain sort of self-programs when we're in a threatening or a traumatic situation. Just
I got so sick of writing that book that I haven't looked at it for a year and a half. So,
oh, I apologize.
No, it's not your fault. It's my fault. Anyway.
The story opens with the Korean War veteran who hears the motorcycle backfire. Right.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, one of the first things that we try to teach people, anybody, whether it's a 5-year-old child or a 50-year-old volunteer coach, when we're talking about the brain, it's really helpful to just have a visual understanding of the way it's put together, the way it's organized. And we use a model of an upside down triangle with the top of the brain is kind of the base of this triangle, and the top of your brain is your cortex. And that's, you know, most people have heard that term, but that's a part of your brain that allows you to have language and think about the past and think about, you know, reflect on the future and all kinds of things. The uniquely human characteristics of our body are really mediated by the cortex. And then as you get lower into the brain, you kind of get into the middle areas of the brain that have systems that are more involved in regulating emotions. And then you get way down to the base of the brain, and you have these systems that are really important in regulating fundamental regulatory capabilities like breathing and body temperature and so forth. So there's this hierarchical organization of the brain. And one of the really most important things, and I think this is universal across every discipline, every area of teaching, coaching, parenting, therapeutics, one of the most important things that we teach people is that all of the sensory apparatus that you have, you know, what you see, what you smell, what you taste, what you feel, the feedback from your body about where you are in space when you're walking, and all your sensory apparatus that tell you about your inside world and the outside world has to go through the bottom part of your brain before it can get to the top part of your brain. So you literally have a sequence of processing information that goes from basically the reactive part of your brain to the emotional part of your brain, and then finally to the thinking part of your brain. And so as a parent or a teacher or a coach, think about how many times you said something like, use your words, or, you know, don't do this, don't, you're giving all kinds of verbal instructions to a kid who's anxious or stirred up or dysregulated or overwhelmed, and also reflect on how ineffective that was. I mean, it really doesn't work to tell somebody to calm down. It actually usually makes them feel more dysregulated, more stirred up. And that's because of the way the brain's organized. So once you start to realize that the brain's organized in a way to basically feel and act before you think, then you have to change the strategies you have for communication. So if you really want to effectively communicate, you have to regulate somebody before you expect your words to get up to their cortex to make much change. And this is really important for coaching. Now, one of the ways that this plays out, and this is sort of, again, I don't want to make this a big science conversation, but when you're growing up, and even in utero, your brain is taking in all of the sensory cues that are coming in into your brain, and it's connecting them. It's connecting sounds with touch. It's connecting images with sounds. It's connecting smells with sounds and feelings. And so your brain starts to create what we kind of refer to as a worldview. And so if you grow up and you're like little Jack, you know, you got parents who are attentive and attuned and smile at you and feed you and all kinds of stuff, your little brain goes, wow, all these, the attributes that collectively make up a human being, human beings are okay. They're safe, they're predictable, they're kind, they feed me, they reward me, they give me pleasure. And so his worldview about people is that by and large, they're pretty good. So the next time he meets a new person, his brain is going to give that person the benefit of the doubt and put them into, this is probably a good person category. And that's because he's got a memory of having good experiences with people. You're going to be a coach out there, and you're going to have kids who, rather than having a catalog that's filled with good experiences, they're going to have a catalog filled with negative experiences, where adults have, you know, these human beings have yelled at me. They haven't been predictable. They haven't been consistent. So when this coach is not trying to communicate with you, that's going to be perceived completely differently than your teammate who's sitting right next to you is hearing the exact same thing. And when those two athletes have completely different responses to what the coach is saying, that will be completely confusing to the coach. And again, so one of the big parts that we try to focus on in this model and in teaching, working with coaches, is teaching them a little bit about these fundamentals about how the brain works. And I think when people start to, you know, if you learn about this, you can just see little light bulbs going off in their heads, because they're starting to remember athletes they worked with that, oh, wow, maybe that explains why so-and-so stormed off. He's one of the greatest athletes I ever worked with. He just couldn't handle coaching. He was uncoachable. And he left. And I think that that's, and I mean, Megan can probably weigh in here about this, but the presentation of these simple but powerful principles really can shift the frame of reference of a coach. And we think to the better of the athletes ultimately.
Yeah. You know, you said something there, Dr. Perry, that I'll have to admit, made me a little self-conscious. You said you are teaching this to five-year-olds. Well, my daughter just turned six a couple of weeks ago. And I'm like, gosh, I haven't taught her anything about the brain yet. So I'm failing as a parent here. I'm all self-conscious.
Well, let me guess.
I'm behind the ball here.
But I'll bet she's taught you a little bit about the brain.
Oh, absolutely. But my absolutely. But I instantly, as you said that, I'm like, you know, I've always, even reading your book, I'm like, okay, it makes sense. This is going to help me to interact in better ways with my players. But I never even wrote, and I just wrote down, we've got to start teaching our players this. And actually, I got to teach my daughter when she comes home, right? So we don't fall behind. No, but like, it's the value of teaching them is huge. And I know that's where you're going to come in, Megan. But I also want to ask you both this, which is this whole thought of like, as I'm reading What Happened to You, I'm not just thinking about my players, I'm thinking about myself. Like, how does it help the coach in managing their own performance so that they can be at the best, at their best, and also find some fulfillment in the journey?
Yeah. Megan, you want to talk about this?
Certainly the thing that comes to mind when, you know, I for me, it's obviously the athlete is the end user and we want their experience to be better. But I think what we find when we talk about this with coaches is that they're saying, yes, like you, JP, they're saying, this will help me be a better coach to my athletes, but this actually helps me be a better partner, father, colleague, human, in a way that I think is for me always the most rewarding part of sort of spending time with coaches and having them walk away saying, this has enriched my life, not just, I know it will enrich the lives of the young people I'm working with, but it's also made my life better. And I think that's so much about when we can help coaches see, I think it comes down to the value of what Bruce was just talking about, the value of being a consistent adult, and or sort of on the other side of the coin, how detrimental it can be when you're not a consistent adult. That the power in that, the power of, I really need to get control over my reactions to things so I can be a predictable adult to the young people that I'm working with, and being able to sort of hold up that mirror and say, the fact that sometimes I lose my cool and sometimes I can keep it under control is actually really not good for the young people I'm around. I think that piece is, for me, the part that when that clicks for a coach, that my emotions are contagious, that what I'm doing is going to set the tone for all of the young people in my care. Bruce, in the book has a part where Oprah is talking about your whisper is a scream. When coaches understand that their whisper can be a scream, I think that really changes the way that they think about themselves and their role. And for me, that's the biggest part, to your point, JP.
And just to add on to that, JP, that one of the things, and you hit on it right away, there are a few sort of these key principles that we think are really helpful. One of them is, Megan just mentioned it, is that human beings are relational creatures. We're literally, it's impossible for contagion of emotion not to take place. And so there's contagion of attitude, and there's contagion of motor activity even. You can see little kids' gestures start to reflect the gestures of the people they're around. And so human beings are remarkably contagious. And if you have a team, the other really important thing to understand is, again, it was, you guys have kind of talked about it, but we refer to it as power differential, that there's, that in a group, the direction of contagion usually goes from the top down, from it goes in the direction of the power differential. And a coach is at the top of a power differential for a team most of the time. Now, sometimes that gets upset, but most of the time. So if the coach can stay regulated and can stay calm in the midst of distress, then you can become the Grim Reaper. Andy Reid talking to Patrick Mahomes in the last 13 seconds of that playoff game didn't panic. He stayed calm and he empowered him and regulated him. And he went out and performed at a level that he could perform at. And of course, the people in the huddle reflected Patrick's calm. And that's what happens in all human interactions, all teams, all work environments. And so now the other thing that's really important about this is sort of a deeper dive on this concept. The reason that was able to work in that moment was because there had been a history of them being consistently regulated, consistently regulated. If Patrick had been the kind of guy who would get unraveled and then was calm and unraveled and then calm, that wouldn't have worked. But it's this, he had been predictably able to deal with, you know, adversity and perform at a high level. And when he was like that in that moment, it was something that was familiar to his, and it helped regulate them. And I think that we see this all the time, you know, that there are some coaches that just lose their shit, basically, when it gets too close and too tense. And more likely than not, those teams are not going to do well in high-pressure situations.
So I just want to follow up real quick on that, because you've kind of just led me to one of the questions I really wanted to ask both of you is, from your perspective, you know, I know, Megan, you spend a lot of time with coaches, maybe Dr. Perry, you spend a little bit less time, but you obviously watch sports. You're an avid sports fan. So is that really our common practice? And they really shouldn't be, you know, that we really need to root out from sports because they're probably not allowed in the workplace or the classroom.
Megan?
you know, I think, JP, you're right. It's exactly building on what we just said. You know, I think so much of it is about the inconsistency too, right? I think, so generally, I think losing your shit, as we just said, is way more accepted in coaching than it should be and is in any other context. Not that there aren't bosses who lose their shit or probably, you know, even other adults who work with young people who do that, but it's sort of not just often sort of passively accepted. It's often encouraged, right? Like, you know, a coach who that's how you motivate kids, that especially these kids today, and that's how you know they need that tough love. They need to be screamed at so that they'll stop doing the thing that, right? Even though we know that sort of punishment doesn't change behavior.
Should mistake losing your shit with your players versus losing your shit with a ref. And I'm not saying that's great either, but it has a different experience for the player when you feel like your coach is being protective of you as opposed to targeting you. The other thing I think, JP, that I think is so detrimental in youth sports, and this is kind of backing into that kind of phase of our work, is it's remarkable how often coaches, and as you know, Megan said it, don't really understand the developmental capabilities of their athletes. And this is particularly true with younger kids. You know, I see this happen with soccer all the time. There will be, and basketball, they will take kids that are 5 and 6 and they'll have them work on very complex plays that require a level of social skill that just their brains just don't have it. And so they, rather than working on very simple individual drills to build certain skills and then, you know, sort of dyadic skills to kind of, you know, learn how to do something with one person, you know, they'll have 5 people involved in some complex play, and then they get frustrated that these kids can't do the inbounds play right. They're 5 years old. I mean, you know, anyway, so that's the kind of thing I think coaches need a lot of help with in youth sport coaches, is just understanding what are the developmental capabilities of kids this age. And then how the developmental capabilities shift under stress. So you can take adolescents who should have the ability to understand a complex thing, and you put them under stress, and all of a sudden their cognitive capabilities to manage complexity diminishes.
We had a really interesting situation at Coach High School girls basketball, and our game on Friday night was senior night. And so we built this 18-point lead, 6 minutes to go in the game. We have five bad possessions in a row. They score at the other end. The game's tied with a minute and a half to go. Three stops down the stretch and force overtime. And so I'm coming into that huddle. You know, we've just blown this huge lead. Our senior post has missed six layups in the game and is feeling that weight on senior night. And, you know, this is something obviously JP and I've been talking about and working on in our own coaching. And I just remember going into that huddle and I just very calm, just saying, look, we know we're the better team. We beat them the first time, you know, by a decent amount or whatever. And we get 4 minutes more to prove that. I'll take that, you know, and you could just feel some of the anxiety sort of leave the huddle. We came out, scored the first 4 points of overtime and go on to win the game. And what was interesting, just, you know, listening to what you're just describing there is in the boys game after that, another close game, and the coach of the other team, so we were ahead, our boys were ahead by two, missed a free throw. They go the other way and throw the ball ahead, and it goes through the guy's hands for what would have been the game-tying layup with 25 seconds or so, a lot of time left in the game, and the coach just loses. I mean, he gets up in the guy's face, and it's kind of embarrassing for, you know, everybody in the gym, and of course, they collapse at the end, and they end up losing. And when I think about, you know, you look at examples like that, a lot of time a coach will say one of two things if you were to confront them on that kind of behavior, whether it's, you know, individually or just theoretically, they would say either, well, that's the way I was coached and I turned out all right, or that's what kids need, because there's this myth that that's how kids become tough, is by going through something like that. What would be your response to that?
You want to go on this and just start with this, Megan?
Yeah. I think we hear all the time, this is how I was coached and I turned out okay, right? Like 100%, that is the answer that overwhelmingly we would get. It makes me think of two things. One is Bruce just talked at the beginning about how you actually build resilience, right? And so if you actually try and help a coach understand that controlled, moderate, and predictable stress is how you build resilience, and, you know, chaotic, unpredictable, and severe stress is how you build vulnerability, and put that interaction into one of those two categories, you can see actually that's not how you make a kid tough. That's not how you make a kid build resilience. That actually you're doing the opposite. So I think that's one for the part about this is what kids need in order to become tough. Well, what I would say is, I know this neuroscientist, he disagrees. Let me tell you about the brain a little. But the part I think that's maybe more complicated is the part around, this is how I was coached and I turned out okay, right? Because number one, yes, you did, right? Like, I don't want to tell you didn't turn out okay in any way, shape, or form, right? So, but I do think for me, when I'm talking to a coach about that, I like for them to get to the place where they can either remember a friend who didn't, right? Mm-hmm. Most likely they had a kid on their team for whom the way they were coached didn't work. Right? They remember that kid. Or sort of this idea that just because it worked for you doesn't mean that it's going to work for everybody else, right? For the range of needs that young people have. It didn't work. That person who you think helped you turn out the way you did also may have not had that positive impact on other people. And now what we want to do is equip you to be able to deal with the range of kids for whom some of them, the way you were coached will work for them, right? They're regulated enough. They have enough support in other parts of their lives. They can handle you being inconsistent sometimes at them sometimes, and they'll turn out okay of you. And that, so how do we get to the place where we can be the because of you coach for multiple different kinds of kids who need different things?
You know, I had an experience once where it was with some coaches, and we had a conversation about, do you feel like you met your potential as an athlete? And none of them did. Yeah. Every one of them felt like, I could have been better. Our team could have been better. You know, we should have won that last game of the season. And you talk with them about what it was. It turns out that they really weren't coached that well. You know, and so when we're working with a group, and we do the same thing with teachers too, we're like, you know, do you feel like you had, were every single one of your teachers perfect? You know, and what did you find yourself not appreciating about a certain kind of teaching? So when we do that, have this sort of reflection on your experience, then it's so much easier to kind of take their own language and their own words and say, here's kind of what you were, I think you were saying is that you wish there had been more opportunities for this or for that. And I think, and of course that's only possible, Nate, if you've got like an ongoing sort of consulting or teaching relationship with a group of coaches. But it might be interesting at some point if some of the people that you coach with, you guys sat down and had some coffee and just talked about, were you the athlete that you wanted to be? I don't know anybody. I mean, it's like, unless you turned out to be Tom Brady, you shouldn't be satisfied with your coaching. Nobody got
Tom
perfect coaching.
Either. You know Tom.
I know.
You, could,
and exactly.
Could have been better.
It's the same. Exactly. That's right. You should have been playing a lot more in college. And
well, we find that, you know, I think building on that, Bruce, is this idea that the people that we find who are willing to look at their own coaching are the ones who need to look at their own coaching the least.
Right.
You know, they're already sort of reflective a little, reflective right. enough to, you know, I'm most worried about the coaches who, and maybe not fully, some of the ones who would say this is their answer may not fall into this category, but the idea of like, I'm okay the way I am, right? Like this is good enough, is the scary part for me yeah. from a coaching perspective.
Yeah. And we run into that in every discipline we work in. And, you know, about one third of the people who are teachers or therapists or scientists or whatever, they don't want to change, and change for them is hard. And part of what we have to do is sort of recognize that, listen, you know, we have to coach them like we want them to coach. So we can either go after them or we can try to help them feel regulated and connect with them. And then maybe they'll hear what we have to say. But it's, you know, I think it's one of the big challenges in systemic change is that, individual change is hard enough, but when you get a bunch of individuals together, it magnifies the challenges that you have in changing things. But it can happen.
All right, that's it for part one of my conversation with Dr. Perry and Megan Bartlett. Two things I absolutely love. Megan talking about, are we an in spite of or a because of coach? I think that is just great. Also, Dr. Perry's point of, did we reach our potential as players? My answer to that is no. I imagine that was your answer as well. You know, it's funny, I had recently had a player who's 27 now. I coached him over 10 years ago, and we have a great relationship. And over the last few years, I've actually tried to almost like apologize and tell him how I could have been better. I could have been better for him as a coach. But for years, he's like argued with me. He's like defended the way that I used to coach. And he's used to, you know, he's told me, hey, I needed you to rip into me and lay into me. Yet recently he's been on this journey to like read more. And so I've been giving him books to read and we've been discussing, and it's been really cool because he started to realize when he looks at the research that I've been right. Like I could have been a better coach. I could have helped him even more. So really appreciate that. And also appreciate Dr. Perry's subtle encouragement to teach our kids about the brain. After this interview, I sat down with my daughter, Elena, who's 6, and Kieran, who's 4.5, and I gave them a 5-minute lesson about the brain, and it was really powerful how easily it actually could be explained and understood. And we talk about the downstairs brain, the upstairs now, and how we want to connect to the upstairs because the downstairs is where the trouble happens. It's pretty cool stuff. So be sure to check out What Happened to You Next week, we'll be back with more, and we'll do a little deeper dive with Megan Bartlett as well to learn more about her work.